Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hello again, Tim.
Hello, Jason.
We're back again. We got letters. You wrote some reviews. You're probably making some lists and checking them twice.
Yes, or four times.
Well, you also have a thing that is totally takes me back, because I used to have to do this too, where you've got like a print deadline. And then you've got like your web version, because there is a print Hollywood Reporter magazine. And I know that, you know, you have to provide for the big year end list issue, presumably a version of a list story that is not the same as the version that runs on the web, because it's probably got some pretty severe space constraints and probably a much more severe time deadline. Right.
Yep. Definitely. Yep. We're Monday is our deadline for our top. We're doing 10. Each, Dan and I, and then doing some episodes and performances, but yeah.
Yeah, so you got to limit it to a top 10 for you and top 10 for Dan for print. And then online, you'll have like 45 shows or something, right?
Yeah, like that.
Pretty much.
450, one of the, sure. Between 45 and 450.
I saw somebody complaining that Black Mirror is apparently not going to be dropping until the close to the end of the year, but
yeah, that's by me.
but you've got screeners of Black Mirror now, right? Or at least
yeah, Black Mirror is going to definitely make my list. It's gonna pop on the definitely, because I think it's great. But it's dropping on the 29th, and because they all drop together, then technically it's a 2017 show on December 29th,
right? So you want to have some you want to be able to evaluate it for your best of 2017, even though, you know, your list is going to come out before the show comes out.
Yes. People will read the list and won't be able to see the show. But then when they do, they will realize that it was worth the wait.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So are you feeling good about Black Mirror?
I am. I loved it. I thought and also, one of the things that I did in my review, I was talking about, I think the show suffers from people when they want to compare it to like previous episodes on the tech spectrum, like what can they dream up that will come true in the future, like a couple of other things that they've done,
right?
You know, how can they dream up something so insane that it'll be such a great hook? And that's not really the show. The show is definitely tech driven, but it's the core of the show is human condition.
Oh, yeah.
So it's always has a heart. It could be a dark heart, but it always has a heart, and it has people at the center, not technology.
Well, it's about how the tech maybe changes how people behave or the society,
sure,
around,
mm-hmm,
the people. But in the end, it's always about what that means for the human beings who are living in that world, right?
Exactly. And I think they did a really great job of that. They even, I wouldn't say poke fun at themselves, but I think that they definitely gave a wink to their own show. With one of this episodes is called Black Museum, which is really, I loved it. It was really great.
I'm looking forward to it. It's great to hear that you're thinking positively about it. It's amazing. A lot of people still haven't heard of it, which I find hard to believe, but they still haven't heard of it. So if you don't know, I had somebody ask me that this week.
Wow.
It's an anthology series.
Uh-huh.
You could watch any of them.
In any order.
I think, there are, you know, there are good episodes and there are bad episodes, in my opinion. But they're all really smart. It's just some of them I find more unpleasant than others. But at the very least, I think if you've got Netflix, you should watch San Junipero, which is a season 3 episode that is just spectacularly good.
It really is, yeah.
And I also really like Be Right Back and Nosedive. Nosedive by Mike Schur and Rashida Jones was really good. And if you're in a dark Christmas mood, White Christmas starring John Hamm is a really good episode too.
I love it. I thought that was a good Christmas episode. I think they'll probably do another one soon.
Yeah, that would be nice. Right. Well, that's that British Christmas special thing. So the idea,
yes,
of a Christmas special. Netflix, they can do whatever. They can.
Do whatever they want. Yeah.
I read a review with Charlie Brooker, who is the mastermind behind this show, about how I found it really encouraging, because he talked about how the response to San Junipero really surprised him. That he was It sounded really interesting because it sounds like it gave him a perspective about his show he didn't have before, about like how everybody expects it to be dark and awful at the end, and people really reacted well to San Junipero and they loved it, and it got nominated for awards and it won an award. And I liked that interview with him because it suggested like he's got a bigger perspective on what he's trying to do with the show than, and maybe, I mean, reading between the lines, maybe he felt like he was kind of stuck in a rut, and that episode and the response to it made him realize that he needs to kind of broaden what he defines as being a Black Mirror episode. And I love that episode, so I'm glad that he took that feedback about how much people love that episode and sort of seems to have integrated it. Like, okay, we can do more. The audience will come with us and maybe even appreciate it if we kind of spread out what we define a Black Mirror story as being about.
Yeah, and I think that I think it was certainly its most, I think, upbeat ending to that one.
Sure.
But I think he was tapping into some of that thread with even in season two with Be Right Back.
I agree,
the first season, the three in the first season were all pretty dark. 15 Million Merits, the one which is the kind of kooky one where they're exercising and generating power and all that stuff. That was dark, but fun and weird in a kind of comic way, a comic book way. That was kind of a downer season. It wasn't until the beginning of the second season when they had Be Right Back. Hayley Atwell was so great in that, and, Domhnall Gleeson and whatever, but it's like I thought that was a different take on Black Mirror, and they continued that obviously when they got to San Junipero, and there's a little bit of that also in an episode called Hang the DJ in this coming season.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. That'll be good holiday break fodder. Watch some Black Mirror and blacken our hearts a little bit with dark stories, but definitely,
yeah, it's really great because I think good. It's also really surprising. There's some episodes where you think, and that's what I like about the series, you think it's going to go in the direction and it doesn't, or it goes way past what you expect. And then even in Black Museum, which I think is going to be one of the standouts, because there is references to previous Black Mirror episodes, and it's definitely about, it's like a, tech paranoia kind of thing. And you kind of know it's going to end badly, but I don't think you know exactly how badly it's going to end. So even when they're kind of like, you're like, oh, I get it. I know what you're doing here. I can see where you're going. It goes a little, it has a little tweak in it, which I think is interesting.
Well, and that's what I took about that interview from him, is that, I think Charlie Brooker is a guy who really doesn't like, he likes to play with audience assumptions. And I think I really got the sense from that interview that he suddenly realized just how there had become this like Black Mirror template, almost like everybody expects like a M. Night Shyamalan movie or a Twilight Zone episode. That's like, oh, well, we know every one of these is like this. And I think that Charlie Brooker does not want to play into your expectations. Like, he always wants to subvert your expectations. And we're at the point now where there's so many expectations about Black Mirror. It's not just about television. It's about his show that he now is subverting his own audience's expectations. And that's great. I love to see a creator do that. So I'm excited.
Yes, me too. And people should be. I think they'll really love it. Also, if people haven't guessed yet, I am under the weather.
Yeah, you're a little sick, but you're rallying. You're rallying. Doing it for the listeners. We appreciate it. Back to the list for a second now, since Black Mirror now has been consumed and considered for your lists. When do you think we're going to see those on the web?
That's really interesting because I used to like be involved in all these other lists with other critics in different places.
And right. Like the consensus lists and stuff.
And I've kind of just winnowed it down. I just do Up Rocks with, Sepinwall. But in the last 2 years that I did that, my list changed by the time, they wanted it from like December 1 to like when I actually filed my story. I think my list is going to be pretty close to that one. And I don't think there's a great surprise at number one, but I think there's going to be three or four surprises in the top 10, maybe five. So it will look different than a lot of people's. I'll guarantee you.
Good. I'm looking forward to it. Well, we'll obviously talk it over here once it's out and public. You know, I assume THR doesn't want you to tease what is on your list, but I don't know.
Well, you know, it's funny because there's really been no guidance. And generally, I just make up. Well, a shocker, I know. But I generally just kind of make everything up as I go along what I want to do. And in the years past, I've had just recently had separate lists of
network
broadcasts.
Yeah, right.
Because it's a different playing field. But you know what? This year, I decided I'm not even going to do that because I'm just going to fold the handful of network shows I like into my list. Because I honestly don't think that I could fairly create a network list.
Right. Well, as we've talked about before, you're not watching a lot of that stuff anyway. So
right.
Pick out the highlights and move on.
Yeah.
All right. It. Okay. Well, maybe we will break down some of your favorites next time. Whether the list is out or not, huh? We'll be rebels.
exactly.
The piece that is up at the Hollywood Reporter that went up yesterday, I saw you promoting it on Twitter. Oh, the irony, because it is about your relationship with Twitter, which you've talked about here a little bit, which mm-hmm. is why I mostly got off Twitter. This is not a thread. So tell me about your relationship. I'm on Twitter all the time. You know, you used to be on Twitter all the time. I definitely see people getting frustrated with Twitter. What's your give me how you're feeling?
Well, I think for me, it's, you know, I mean, the spoiler to the story is it's essentially, a time management thing.
Sure.
But I was also really frustrated with it. I think, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I've made many attempts to try to get off. And I joke around that there is kind of this crack element to it. I've been on since February of 2009. So I guess we're coming up on 8 years or so. It's a long, long time to be on that. And, I just think it's changed so much. I think that the election hurt it. I think because it's just too much of the same. And I have reasons, mostly time, because I think the job of a TV critic is so it's the pressure, the time pressure is it's actually overwhelming. I mean, it's just obviously you're not going to get sympathy because people actually work real jobs and physical jobs. But it's just the time commitment. Which I've said this before, I don't think my bosses understand at all, but you know, I'm constantly watching TV. You're always working weekends and whatever. And so anytime you get free time to do something other than that, and I've joked many times about never seeing many movies because of that, but like reading and stuff. So even though it's a time thing, what I get into in this story is that one of the main reasons that I quit beyond that, which is the main one, was that like, I don't think it's a very good place to be for a critic right now. I think there are too many people who are sort of floating trial balloons about whether they're going to like a show, whether other people like a show or not. And it's before those people have written their reviews. And I don't like that. And, you know, because it's, I think there's something about being early on a review or being out on an island. Being early means you don't know
right.
how anybody's going to react to it. Being on an island is what happens after people react to it. And you are the only one. But with Twitter and tech and all that stuff, it's just so fast these days. It's hard to, like, you really have to be in a magazine to get out early, because you just do. But I just think people who were on it, I certainly wouldn't name names, but there's a lot of people who are using it in ways that I just don't agree with critically. And, there's something to be said about, like, just believing in your own stuff and going with that. I don't think it's abused, but I think, for lack of a better word for it, like less established critics, meaning like people who maybe are more fanboy or fangirls, and there's a number of those in our mm-hmm. business, they are particularly sensitive to being swayed. So, I follow some of them, and I'm certainly aware of them, but I mean, I don't think that like, I don't think you're going to get like Dan Feinberg or Alan Sepinwall or, me or Panawaz. Like they're not going to, those writers are not going to be like, Everybody hates this show, so I better hate it. You know, they're just going to put their opinions in there. I think people who are, like I said, more from a fangirl, fanboy base, they can be swayed. And so I see a lot of like crowdsourcing of opinion on Twitter. I don't like it. But for me also, it's like, I get into how like it was kind of the perfect social media platform for me. You can be snarky, you can be like make jokes, but you can be serious. You can do all kinds of things. You can talk about any whatever you wanted, personal stuff. But for me, I think you fall into that hole, and 8 years is a long time. And I felt like all of my critical faculties were being erased because I wasn't reading other books. I wasn't looking at, you know, anything outside of television, essentially, that contributes to a greater understanding of the world, which might help you even, for example, understand Black Mirror better. Maybe if there's some kind of, if you're reading more philosophy, or maybe even if you're reading something that's scientific based, or personality based, that's more of a science journal, that can shape how you approach a show like Black Mirror. And I wasn't, for me personally, I was not getting enough of that. And my vocabulary really started to reek. And, you know, we do so many reviews. There's pressure to churn out so many reviews in the busy times. If I look back at some of those reviews, I'm like, wow, yep, that definitely looks like I was racing to finish that. Or I'm like, I really love this word and this word a lot. So I tried to fix it.
Yeah, it's talking about being, I mean, the purest response you're going to get is being in a vacuum, having an embargo or something like that, where you just have to search your own personal feelings about a product, or there's mine, right? Or yeah. Or a product, a movie, right. A TV show, whatever. And then there's, I mean, I will sometimes, I try not to read reviews when I'm writing a review. Every now and then coverage of something will come up and I'll be like, oh, that's a good point. I hadn't, not like the opinion about it, but like, oh yeah, that's a whole dimension of this that I didn't really, I wasn't planning on addressing that maybe I should address. I pick that up sometimes, but the danger there is that everything in the refrigerator starts to taste like the most strong flavor that's in the refrigerator, the most strong ingredient. Everything smells like an onion or, you know, whatever it is that's in there. And then you don't have a diversity of opinions anymore. You've just got a bandwagon.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. Also, I mean, boy, during the election and after, I mean, I heard from people said that it was therapeutic, and also people who said that they had to get off of it because, the mood of Twitter, depending on who you're following, can also really kind of bring you down. And that's a tough one too. I use Twitter a lot, but I mean, I don't use it like I used to. I have disengaged a huge amount of my personal and observational stuff and taken it to private places like Slack groups and things where it's people I know more or less, and that there aren't going to be people driving by who don't know me, I don't know them, and are happy to spray kind of awful things my way. Like those people, I have no desire to interact with those people. I'm fast with the block, fast with the mute. I don't want those people in my life, but it doesn't matter. There'll be new people the next time you do something like that. So it's just like, you know, that's one of the side effects is, you know, you're still on Twitter, but basically what you're doing on Twitter is brand, you know, it's the personal brand of Tim of what your stuff is and all of that. And it's not quite the same as it used to be.
And even that's back because I think I remember when I first started and I certainly bought into the notion that like you can't just tweet out your links because no one's going to care that you're just selling people thing or giving people something, but technically you're selling. If you don't actually share with them and you share a little bit of yourself, if you're just a link machine, no, people don't care. And I bought into that and I shared a lot of things and I still like to interact with people. That really has not driven it. I'm with you too. I'm quick with the block, quick with the mute. And I address those in the story. I think for me that I don't think I need to build my brand anymore. I certainly would if I ever finished this music book and I'll go back on. Like I said, I have like 10%. I'm like off the, based on what I was using before. Let's just say the bandwidth. I'm only using 10% of it now because I'm 90% off Twitter. The irony, of course, was back in there promoting the Twitter thing on Twitter, promoting the anti-Twitter column on Twitter. But I thought that's where it would be the most use. And I'll be back if I do music stuff, which I intend to. I don't feel like I'm promoting my brand anymore. I did make a mention that that it's really hard when you work at THR and it's a high churn site, my stuff gets lost really quickly. So it's important for me to get out there and put it out. So I still do that. I think the bigger question I didn't raise is like, is that really my job? Because technically it shouldn't be. It should be THR's job. You know, there should be somebody saying, hey, these washed off, but they're still really good stories. We need to find a place for them. I don't think there's a real answer for that. And it's probably not going to work numbers wise. There's just so many stories and so many people writing. But I do the best I can. I don't think I worry about it as much as in the past when we were talking about brand building. But what I found out, Jason, is that you made a good point. You said personal and private, personal observations and things that are those kind of things. For me, I always, the lure of Twitter when I'm on there, and I'm not on there very much, when I get back on there, I see stuff and it triggers me and I want to respond to it because that's what I used to do. And I'm sure you've had that too.
Sure.
And I always ask myself, do you need to do that? Do you want to? Do you have the time to do that? Would your time be better spent doing something else than getting in this fight? Or worse, or much more subtle is what I mean. Do I need to say, you know, in 140 or 280 or how many characters you want, do I have to say what I want to say? Is there a need for that? It's in some ways it is like sitting around talking to people on, you know, in a cafe or whatever. But I don't do that a lot either because I have other things to do in my life. So I found like I don't need to go on Twitter to say something that's inconsequential. And if you take that tweet and you multiply it by, you know, 10,000 of meaningless tweets, quote unquote meaningless, if you don't do those, then you have all that time can be devoted to reading or doing something else. And that's basically what I'm doing. I'm stopping the need to comment on everything.
Yeah, I hear that. I came to the realization a while ago that I had originally treated Twitter as sort of a zone with people who knew me, and it was kind of a friendly like place for me to share, you know, the old joke about social media being like what you had for breakfast, that kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, I definitely came to the realization that at this point, Twitter is a performance. I am performing when I post something on Twitter. I didn't used to be that way, but I have put up shields and removed certain kinds of things that I used to share. And now whenever I write anything, I am aware of all the ways it's going to be misunderstood, all the people who are going to use it in, you know, to misread it deliberately in order to anything from as benign as make a stupid joke to as malign as twist it and use it to put forth some kind of horrible agenda. And I've bottled all of that in, and then I've knocked out everything else that I used to share. So it's just that awareness that like writing an article and having it run in a magazine or a newspaper or on a website, right? It's the same thing. It's a performance and it's calculated and crafted. And the fact is Twitter is like that now too, because I have to, you know, I have to do it that way and you have to do it that way. I spend more time on Twitter with looking at my replies actually, because then looking at the stuff kind of spewed into my timeline and my list. I've got a sports list, and that's kind of like, it's nice to take me away and talk about like people writing about sports and stuff instead of awful things in the world. So yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, it's you got to draw those boundaries, and I just had one line in there where I just said it's more interesting to be on Instagram where actually I'm not selling anything. I barely mention television. And, you know, I'll take a picture of some swag things and maybe what I'm doing, but it's about the pretty pictures, and I love what I follow, and people who choose to follow me are going to get a lot of pictures of wine, and probably some books.
Nice.
Reference books.
I wanted to mention two friends of the show who have launched podcasts.
Oh, okay.
Just mentioning them. Peter Hartlaub at The Chronicle has a podcast which has appeared now on iTunes called The Big Picture. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Question Boy himself, Joe Garofoli, has a political podcast that I believe in the Chronicle tradition, they start the podcast and then like a month or two later, it shows up on iTunes. But Joe, so when that happens, I'll let people know where it is. But
yeah, I believe his is called It's All Political, right?
It's All Political, right? Because, because QB is a politics writer for the Chronicle now. And so he's got a political podcast and he's interviewing interesting people. And then Peter Hartlob's is exactly what you'd expect a Peter Hartlob podcast to be, which is it's got movie stuff and history stuff because he digs through the Chronicle archives. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there. I've listened to a couple of those. And Chronicle, it turns out, they have a Giants podcast now. They're getting into podcasting, Tim. At long last, the Chronicle is back in podcasting.
I was wondering if we were going to address that because
it only took 11 years.
Yeah, it
after is the tail TVTM.
End. Exactly, it is the tail end of 2017. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this push began less than 2 weeks ago.
Well, Peter's podcast started being posted a couple months ago, and I was asking him about him on Twitter. Actually, I was asking him about it, and because he was asking advice about like where should we host it and all that. And they're in SoundCloud, which everybody kind of believes is going to go out of business, but they're Chronicles and SoundCloud, so all right, good luck. But that was a while ago, and he said, "Yeah, and they're working on getting into iTunes." I'm like, "You got to be in the iTunes. You can't just be on SoundCloud. You got to be in the directories. Yeah. iTunes feeds into like every other directory that's out there. It's like the Apple Podcasts. It's not iTunes anymore. The Apple Podcasts directory. You got to be in there." And he's like, "Yeah, I know. And it's finally there. But all the others that they've announced since then, including a bunch in the last couple of weeks, are still not there.
Yeah.
So it's not quite 11 years, but it's 10 years and 10 months since the first episode of the first iteration of TV Talk Machine. It's good to see. And there was, of course, Ask Mick LaSalle. That was a podcast back then. But it's like the wheel turns. And now all of a sudden, 10 years later, all your old pals at the Chronicle are kind of back in the podcast game. So good for them.
It is kind of funny. I did notice. I mean, I know that Peter's been doing his for a little bit, but the huge emphasis on it in the last 2 weeks has been like a lot of other people launching their podcast, and I thought, oh, that's good. I guess the Chronicle discovered podcast, and you know, I would like to take them through a tour of what used to be the second floor and say, remember this where no one ever came down to this little hole in the wall, but there was a studio there. It's awesome.
I never got to see that studio. The only studio that I went in is the one where it was also like some salesperson's office. Do you remember that?
Oh, what was that one?
Oh, yeah, that was like it was a room, and it had like some buzzing electrical something, and there was also a desk there that was like some woman who was a salesperson.
Oh, okay, yes, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, was that where the glass booth was?
That may be, yeah.
That was
weird.
A good one.
That was really weird. But anyway, congratulations to the Chronicle and to Joe and Peter about doing podcasts now. Welcome to podcasts. It's good. Want to do some letters?
Let's do that.
All right. Really quickly, we got a few. Martha from the 925 wrote in to say, I had to comment on Tim's Critics Notebook about Twitter. The only reason I signed on was to get Tim's updates on his columns and then slowly added other critics, Jason for his Incomparable Network updates, and some friends. I've been more a voyeur or a lurker than someone who actively tweets. Post-election got so bad I removed it off my iPhone and only check it on my iPad once or twice a day. Much better and keeps one's sanity at an acceptable level. I agree.
Oh, that's very nice.
That's very nice. But she's Martha's watching us from the 925. Donnie in the 206 writes, since Tim's two passions are TV and music, that got me thinking, what TV shows feature the best use of music, either score or song selection? For song selection, both The OC and Girls come to mind as two shows that introduced me to new bands I would never have known otherwise. For iconic scores, You Can't Beat Lost, Battlestar Galactica, or Game of Thrones. For a current show that combines both really well, my vote is for Mr. Robot. What do you guys think? Donnie in the 206.
Yes, Mr. Robot is
so good. Yeah,
so good.
Matt Quayle's electronic score is really, really good, and the music selection. I think I mentioned this last week. There was that bar scene with a Church's song in it, and I'm like, all right, they're like the music they're playing really fits, and it's good music, and I like that too. And you know, they threw in the Knight Rider theme. I think that's a winner for sure.
Yeah, I think the CW series incorporate music pretty well.
Yeah, I don't know whether they have a music supervisor for all the shows, or whether there's somebody at the CW who really is sort of like, say, here are some hot music that you could you guys could put on, because it seems network wide they do a good job.
Yeah, they do. And I think that also, I mean, I loved way back. I mean, Gilmore Girls ages ago was to me was by far the best.
I was going to say
she really knew how to curate a playlist.
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the end credits for that have a song every time, and it is a perfect thematic choice. It's obviously being done by Amy Sherman-Palladino.
Right.
Perfect thematic choice. It's not always period. A lot of them are modern, but just perfectly matched. And you can tell the shows where there's somebody there who really cares about music, and the ones where they don't.
Somebody just adds something on for them. Yeah. No, Amy Sherman-Palladino has always had a tremendous ear. I say that because a lot of stuff she likes is stuff that I really like. So.
it's a good question. The other one that I came up with is Scrubs. Believe it or not,
Scrubs did too.
I think they had really good music choices that they made. I like the fact that they chose, what is it, Superman by Laszlo Bane is the theme song. It's a good theme song that they kind of picked off the pile a little bit. Like, it reminds me a little bit of how You're the Worst just found this band Slothrust on like the internet and liked that song. And now it's Stephen Falk was like, yeah, that's the theme song. That's kind of cool. Yeah. But I also discovered great bands from Scrubs. Say Anything, the pop punk band from that I really like, they used in Scrubs a couple of times. And the OC was like, I think, majorly responsible for a more broad understanding of Death Cab for Cutie, which I'm always going to be for.
Yeah, and as much as I hate Twin Peaks Returns, I mean, the bands that they had play in the lodge there,
right,
they were good.
If you got cursed by a genie and were forced to live inside Twin Peaks The Return, you'd just stay in the bar and listen to the music all the time.
Music, yeah.
Good call.
Everything else is stupid, but I can drink it away in here.
Good call. I think that's about right. Let's see. Jake from the 617 wrote in to say, I wanted to check in if you've seen or heard of the German Netflix series Dark. It was recently added, but I haven't heard any critical chatter about it, which is a shame because it's excellent. Without giving too much away, I have a strong feeling you would really love it. It's clearly intended to coast off Stranger Things success, but it veers a lot closer in tone to something like The Returned, with some of the OA and even Broadchurch, but German. I also wanted to issue a warning to anyone who wanted to check it out, but were turned off by the terrible English dub. You can use your Netflix app to switch it to German with English subtitles, and it's much better. Now, when Jake sent this letter in, Jake from the 617, I had not heard about it. But just afterward, I began to hear about it. Dan Feinberg reviewed it and gave it a positive review. It's kind of a middling positive review. It does sound like it's kind of like sort of Stranger Things, but like way darker and weirder. I started watching the first episode, and I haven't gone further than that. But I did take Jake's advice and put it in German with English subtitles, because I don't even want to know how bad that English dub is. I'm not even interested in that.
No, not interested at all. But I probably won't watch it because it's too much in the horror realm and the scary, freaky realm. Yeah. And that's not my favorite realm. So,
yeah, but I think it's an interesting thing for people. And there's a little talk about it, but not a lot of talk. So if you like, especially Stranger Things, or that description of like Stranger Things with The Returned or the OA and Broadchurch, but German, it is German. But you should check it out. It's on Netflix. Everybody in the world gets to watch it, even though they made it in Germany.
I had a friend who's watching it, and she said it's Stranger Things, but scarier and with no humor.
Well, it's
so basically again, not it's German. Stranger Things, right?
Yeah, <You know? laughs> no, it sounds, and it's got multiple time frames apparently, and all sorts of things, and yeah, it's all good. I have a couple of tweets. Matthew in the 602 wrote in to describe Steven Soderbergh's Mosaic as "Choose Your Own Rashomon," which is
nice. Clever.
I will say, to be clear, the perspective shifts when you use the Mosaic app are not, they are all intended to be the same. So you're seeing other backstory, but like, it's not like the events portrayed differ based on who is the observer. like Rashomon, where everybody's got a different account of events. It's all just, you're seeing different perspectives, but it's not like the events are different. In fact, I suspect that in some cases they were shooting with multiple cameras so that they could use the different angles from the same scene in the same way. I finished that, by the way, and I thought it was pretty good. It's
really?
It's
you got
weird.
All the way through it.
Yeah, I did. It's weirdly structured because it's intentionally weirdly structured, but I thought it was pretty good. I think as a murder mystery it works okay, where there's some really weird red herrings where you're like, oh, this person totally did it, and then the next episode you're like, oh, this person totally did it, and then it just kind of keeps going like that, which is, I think that's good to be, I think it uses its structure to disorient you a little bit about the mystery part of it, and I think that's good.
Right.
And there are characters
right.
who don't seem important who are important, characters you think are jerks who turn out to not be jerks, and it's kind of like life, you know, it's kind complicated, and I like that about it. I'm interested to see how they cut it for linear TV for HBO. That'll be different.
Yeah.
Anyway, I finished it, so I can give it a thumbs up for having finished it. Let's see. Dean in the 707 tweeted at us saying, "I'm greatly enjoying The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel," which I finished this week, and I really liked it. But twice they've used the word nerd, which is possible, I guess, but it seems like an anachronism, and I feel badly for her kids who don't get the attention they need, which is what I said last week, right? Which is like, they want to show her life, but the kids are really not, like, they're too complex to deal with, like, the logistics of the kids. So they're always in bed or with grandma or something like that. And Dean is totally right about the anachronisms. Nerd doesn't even begin. There are so many anachronisms, and yeah. I just went with it because, quite honestly, beyond a certain point, these characters might seem less likable if they spoke like somebody in 1958
yeah,
actually
exactly.
spoke. And you want to, like with Mad Men to a certain degree, maybe not this much, you want these characters to be accessible, right? You don't want them, I mean, Mad Men didn't want you too close to them, but that's sort of its appeal. But like Mrs. Maisel wants you to give like these characters and give them a hug and kind of understand them. And, you know, language can distance you. If they're talking like somebody who, you know, like, I don't even know who this person is, I feel like that puts too much distance between, that's my theory anyway, between the character and the audience.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because it's full of anachronisms in dialogue. Uh-huh. Also, it's Amy Sherman Palladino wants like snappy dialogue, and your brain is going to not go with her super fast, snappy, funny dialogue if you're translating out of like something they might say in the 50s. And also, that's her lexicon. Like, she wants to use kind of modern lexicon when she needs to in order to make her jokes and things like that. So I get it. But I, as a nerd, not a word that they would use in 1958, I totally had those moments of like, no, nobody would say that. And I just had to let it go because I enjoyed the ride.
Right.
Even though totally not, I don't know. I mean, it's a TV show, right? It's not, to a certain point, it would take a lot for me to be totally break down and be like, no, this is historically inaccurate, if it was a show I was enjoying, right?
Right, right.
Doesn't, I mean, there is a point where you buy in, as you've said many times. And when you buy in, then you forgive a lot.
You just, once you're in, you're just like, okay, unless something changes and they do it to the point where you're like, okay, this has now changed it for me. I can't do it.
I actually wonder because I don't think there's anything like this in the first season. I would be shocked if the second season of that show does not directly address how a woman in a man's world of comedy in the late 50s would probably have men behaving very badly toward her.
Yeah.
In terms of groping and things,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time believing that won't be in the second season. Because
I'm with you.
I don't know how. I mean, because I actually was wondering, because that's one of the places where that show takes a really light touch, is they mention, you know, racism and sexism and all of that. And there is the overarching concept, which is that society wants her to be a housewife and she is not fulfilled with that and wants to do something else. But like in the details, it happens occasionally, but like it's a real light touch. And I wonder if that'll continue. I don't know.
Yeah, we will find that.
You
were the leader on that, because I'm not sure. I've just so many other things. I'm not sure I'll continue with it.
Well, I'll tell you, I really liked it. If I had a top 10 list, it would be on it. I really liked it. So for what it's worth. One last letter. And
okay.
this is big picture stuff, but we'll go out on this one, which is from Micah in the 415, area code of record. So some of Tim's comments have me wondering what Tim's take is on the role of a TV critic. Tim's defiance about Twin Peaks disappointed me, not because we disagreed, but because he communicated his motivation to continue watching the show was not out of interest, but to confirm that his views or that the views and the experiences of fellow critics were, for a better lack of a better word, wrong. Last week, Tim again pointed aim at negative reviews of Godless for similar reasons. TV and film provide viewing experiences that are bound to land on different people in different ways, whether it's due to lack of attention, indifference to the subject matter, a variety of other reasons. That's okay. No critic has the power to define the experience that goes on in someone else's head. I feel TV criticism should reflect the perspective of its author, but it becomes harder to take at face value when I sense a motive to convince the reader one way or another. Tim's Fargo review is positive, beaming with excitement, and made me want to watch it more. I appreciate it as a seemingly authentic record of a viewing experience. If a critic's piece seems written to convince readers from watching something, I turn off from their perspective. I'd prefer the criticism contained to the critic's experience than let me, the reader, determine how much weight I want to put on their words and how it may impact my desire to sample a new show. Back to the role of the critic.
That is very big picture, because I think that, to go all the way back, I think I said I was going to watch Twin Peaks because I wanted to see if it actually got better and made sense rather than passing.
And you can't take anyone's word for that, right? You can't see it for yourself.
And I did what, 9 episodes? So that to me is, I think I said it became hate watching because I hated it, but like, and I don't believe in hate watching. I think if you don't like something, you should turn it off and not go. I wanted to see if I was missing something specifically, and I just gave up on it because I just couldn't. But I think there's something about being able to vociferously engage in a conversation amongst critics about whether something is good or not. I think that there, I actually believe that's totally fine.
I like it when you and Dan went back and forth about what was the HBO show with the rich white women who
Big Little Lies.
Big Little Lies, right? You guys go back and forth on that because he liked it and you didn't like it?
A number of things, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was more in the Twin Peaks box than I was.
Yeah,
Big
right.
Little Lies is going to have a second season, by the way. Boo. But, there's your precursor review. I joke about that, but I probably won't review it, but I will watch it. And if it's better, I'll say it's better. But I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think, first of all, I think I write all my reviews from the perspective of whether I care about it, not whether the audience is going to care about it or another critic is going to care about it. I like never have I ever done a review where I worried about the audience. It was like, I either like it or I don't like it. That's what I do. And anybody who's, I think it goes back to that thing where I said, I got off Twitter where people were trying to please people. I'm not trying to please anybody except for myself. And I also know that, I didn't really have it. I mean, you and I have talked about it on this podcast a little bit well in the past. But like when you say, I don't care what people think, that could be really off-putting to some people if they don't understand where you're coming from. It's like, I'll listen to it. But like if I cared what, you know, if I cared what another person thought of my opinion, then I wouldn't be a very good critic. And it's also like, you know, there are people who I respect greatly as critics who really love Twin Peaks. So that doesn't mean I respect them less, but I don't care that they like Twin Peaks because I only care that I don't like it. So I would love to argue with them, and we've done a little bit of that. But like in the big picture, everybody likes what they like. I think people go to critics and then they'll find out based on, you know, I do that. I go to like movie critics wherever and say, I know there's certain one that you and I have mentioned, but we won't drop the name. But when this person likes a movie, I know I'm going to hate it. And when this person loves a movie, I know I'm going to hate it. You know what I mean? Or hates a movie, I know I'm going to love it. So I think you can do that. And I found a couple of music critics I really enjoy their taste in music, which is much harder to fathom for me. But like, I don't know. I don't think that the intent, I definitely try to dissuade people from watching a show if I think it's terrible, because my overriding thing in the last 10 years is, and especially the last 5, is that time is the most valuable commodity to viewers.
Well, and this
or
is
to
this
general
is,
population.
You know, I believe very strongly that we are in the service journalism business, and or you could call it news you can use. That was a big catchphrase for a while. The fact is, the role of a there are a few roles. There's a role of a critic as an analyst of culture and things like that, which you do some of too in your essays. But part of it is, should I waste my time on this show, right? Should I invest right. that time I've got? And so I'm not quite sure I agree with Micah's alignment here in the sense of a motive to convince the reader, because in the end, every review is meant to serve a reader in their decision-making process about whether they should spend time on a show or not. Now, I get that maybe it's a turnoff to Micah if you say don't watch it versus this is bad, but I do think that the implications or the intentions are the same, which is you've seen so much TV that you can tell even if something's not bad, if it's mediocre, you could say there are better options than this. And is it, you know, is it too far when you say don't watch this, watch one of these other shows instead? I guess I could see how somebody might be bothered by that, but it doesn't bother me because I feel like implicit in anything, any review you write, you're saying you should watch this or you shouldn't watch this. Now, you know, I don't know. Maybe Micah doesn't like negativity so much, and it's more about like finding the gems rather than kind of giving the finger to stuff that that you disliked. And I get that. I some people much prefer unearthing. Siskel and Ebert always talked about that, that the proudest things that they had were finding the hidden gems. When you talked about like Detectorists or something like that, you know, any one of these shows that nobody's heard of that you really liked, that is a certain kind of criticism. But I don't know. It is, in my mind, this is about equipping people with your experience went into it so that they can avoid it if it sounds like something that is wrong for them, or seek it out if it's right for them. And that is ultimately, should you watch this or not?
Right. And I think you're only just like, I think my, it's just like a guidepost, right? Like,
yeah, take it for what it's worth.
When people say they don't like a movie or they don't like an album, I'm still going to listen to it, or I'm still going to go. If I see the preview and I think, oh, this is really good, that looks really exciting, and then people say that's stupid, I'm like, well, you know what? All right, I'll take that into consideration, but there was something about it that compels me to go see it, which is really rare. So on television, even if I pan something, if you saw a preview or it has actors in it or somebody created it who you like, by all means, you know, watch it yourself and find out for yourself. I'm just a guide, just helping to be a guide, basically.
Yeah, I think that's about right. It is an interesting thing about this, like what the role of the critic is, and you know, and going back and forth with other critics, I think it's reasonable. Look, nobody is actually literally wrong with their opinion. I think it's more disagreeing on the extremes of it. And if I can speak for you, when you say, well, look, that's wrong, generally, you know, it's not intended that person literally has a wrong opinion. It's just like you don't agree with it, and I think that's fair too. But at the same time, you know, everybody gets an opinion, including the readers and the listeners, right? They can take it away. Like, I like Mrs. Maisel way more than you do, and I think the Tony Shalhoub stuff is hilarious, and you're like, it's disappointing.
Exactly.
So that's fair. I get it.
<It's> disappointing. That's funny.
I get it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks to Micah for writing a thoughtful letter.
It was very thoughtful, yes.
And all of us, that the beauty of criticism, I think, as a reader of it, or a listener to it, is in the end, you get to make the decision, and you can disregard or embrace as needed. The power is entirely in your hands, and it's probably a remote control, and you can make that decision yourself based on the information provided. Except on Tim TV. Once Tim TV happens, you just press play.
Once that app happens, boy, we're going to be rich. Mm.
All right, well, we have to go. That's it. Tight and bright-ish. And here's how you reach us. Tweet at us at TVTM. That's the best place. You could tweet at Tim, but he probably isn't going to see it. And, you know, it's fine. At TVTM, facebook.com/TV Talk Machine. If you want to post something there, you can post in the comments or in the user posts. And email is a great way to reach us, podcast@TVTalkMachine.com. And that's it. Until next time, Tim, good luck with the lists.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.